Some of you may not have heard about our guests, so let me introduce them to you. Dr. Richardson is a member of the American Anthropological Association, and he currently serves as their national co-chair of the Committee for Promoting Public Understanding of Evolution. Dr. Richardson is a former president of the Southern Anthropological Society, and he currently serves as the editor of Anthropology and Humanism Quarterly, which is a national journal published by the Society for Humanistic Anthropology. A native Texan, Dr. Richardson attended Stephen F. Austin State University, where he earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in History and Biology. After attending graduate school here at LSU, he studied at Tulane University in New Orleans, where he earned the PhD degree in Anthropology. Dr. Richardson's name appears as editor or author of three books from the social cultural anthropology discipline. His research has appeared in a number of professional journals, including American Anthropologist and American Ethnologist. Dr. Richardson also enjoys writing fiction and poetry. This fall, Dr. Richardson began his 20th year of service at LSU. Among his other teaching responsibilities, he teaches a course in the evolution of man and culture, which is an upper-level course open to undergraduates as well as graduate students. The Department of Philosophy and the chapel on the campus are pleased to have representing this evening the evolutionist perspective, Dr. Miles Richardson. Would you welcome him with us? Opening speaker this evening, Dr. Norman Geisler. There are few individuals who are better qualified to present the creationist perspective than Dr. Norman Geisler. Dr. Geisler holds professional memberships in at least seven different professional associations, including the Evangelical Philosophical Society, which he served in 1976 as its first president. A prolific writer, his text entitled The Philosophy of Religion was named a Choice Evangelical Book of the Year by the editors of Christianity Today. As an author of 21 books and numerous articles in the popular Christian press, Dr. Geisler is in great demand as a public speaker. He's lectured at universities, colleges, and churches in 49 states and at least 9 foreign countries. Dr. Geisler earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy from Wheaton College in Illinois. He also holds a master's degree in theology from Wheaton College. He was awarded a seminary degree from William Tyndale College, his Master of Arts degree in philosophy from the University of Detroit. He's taken additional coursework in philosophy at Wayne State University and Northwestern University of Illinois. Dr. Geisler was awarded the PhD in philosophy from Loyola University in Chicago. A former chairperson of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School's Philosophy of Religion Department, Dr. Geisler is in his seventh year now as professor of systematic theology at Dallas Theological Seminary. A former minister of churches in Michigan, Illinois, and Texas, Dr. Geisler has active radio and television ministries. And in fact, in 1982, one of his creation evolution debates was carried nationally by NBC Television. The sponsors of this evening's debate are pleased to present to you our first speaker this evening, representing biblical creationism, Dr. Norman Geisler.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here and to share the platform with a distinguished scientist and scholar as Dr. Richardson is, and to dialogue on a very important and crucial topic. Some time ago, over the ape's cage at the Milwaukee Zoo, someone had inscribed these words, which summarizes our topic for this evening: "Am I my keeper's brother?" We'd like to, in discussing the question of origins, I would like to distinguish first two kinds of science. Science that deals with the present based on observation and repetition, some recurring pattern over against which one can test a theory, and science which deals with past events, which has no direct observation of the event and no recurring pattern of the event that it can observe. consequently is dependent on the principle of causality, assuming that every event has an adequate cause, and the principle of uniformity or analogy, which says what we see to be an adequate kind of cause in the present may be posited to be an adequate kind of cause in the past of that same kind of event. When we're dealing with the questions of origin, there are two basic views. One is a naturalistic perspective, and one is a supernatural perspective. And there are three main areas of controversy: the origin of the universe, cosmic evolution, the origin of first life forms, biogenesis, and the origin of new life forms, including man. As you know, for the first 240 years of science, from 1620 to 1860, the supernatural perspective dominated. Since 1860, the naturalistic perspective has dominated, and the roles of majority and minority have been reversed. Again today, there are numbers of scientists who are returning to a supernatural perspective with regard to origin, and I'd like to defend that perspective this evening. Let me begin by discussing the origin of the universe. Either the universe had no beginning, or it had a beginning. If it had a beginning, it either had no cause or it had a cause. Now, since scientific rational thought is predicated on the premise that every event has an adequate cause, we can eliminate that one and discuss whether or not there is scientific evidence for the universe having a beginning. Because if the universe, the cosmos, the whole show, had a beginning, then it is reasonable to postulate a cause for the beginning of the universe. Let me begin my presentation of that by saying that the second law of thermodynamics, which says in a closed, isolated system, such as the universe as a whole would be, the amount of usable energy is decreasing. Now, we're all aware of the fact that this is not true of plants or living things because they're an open system. But the universe as a whole is a closed, isolated system. And in closed, isolated systems, the amount of usable energy decreases. In other words, the universe is running down. Nuclear fission is taking place, and this is true throughout the universe. That has led even agnostic astronomers, such as Dr. Robert Jastrow, who is the founder and director of the Goddard Institute for Space Research, chosen by the United States to represent us on television in a dialogue with the Russians, to say, there are three lines of evidence: the motion of the galaxies, the laws of thermodynamics, and the life story of the stars, that point to one conclusion. All indicate that the universe had a beginning. The expanding universe, the radiation echo discovered by Penzias and Wilson, for which they were given Nobel Prize, and the second law of thermodynamics all point to one striking fact. The most striking fact that science has discovered, says the agnostic Dr. Robert Jastrow, is that there was a beginning of the universe. But if there was a beginning, then there must have been a beginner. If the universe had a beginning, there must have been a cause, because every event has an adequate cause. The only adequate cause for the beginning of the whole natural universe would be a supranatural cause. He goes on to say, cancer research in Dallas took this picture. It's one of the first pictures of a DNA splitting under electron microscope. In a single cell animal, there's enough information that, if spelled out in English, would fill one volume of an encyclopedia. Now, here's what the creationist says. The first living thing, a one-cell animal that appeared in Darwin's little warm pond or the primeval soup, whatever you have, the prebiotic soup, that first thing had enough information to fill a volume of an encyclopedia. Now, what do we know from previous experience is the only adequate cause to regularly produce that kind of thing? Intelligence, for example. If you're on the beach and you look up in the sky and you see "drink Coke" in the clouds, what do you immediately assume? Bad storm. Bad storm. No, even that simple information, you assume intelligent creator. If you come to the breakfast table and the alphabet cereal is spilled, and in the middle of the alphabet cereal, it spells out your name and address, what do you immediately assume? The cat knocked it over. The fan was blowing on it. No natural cause known to man will ever regularly produce specified complexity. Now, the first living thing had not "drink Coke," two words, or a sentence. It had a volume full of information in it, and that speaks of an intelligent creator as opposed to a purely natural cause.
Herbert Yockey in the Journal of Theoretical Biology in 1981 applied information theory discovered by the Bell Laboratory to the DNA. He concluded that the relationship between the order of letters in the information of a human language and that represented in a DNA is mathematically identical. That is, if it takes an intelligent being to produce a language, then it took an intelligent being to produce the DNA of the first living thing. Carl Sagan, one of the most famous evolutionists today, says that if we received a single message from outer space, we would know there were intelligent beings there. Now, if you received a single paragraph from outer space and that was a proof of intelligence, how about if you receive a whole volume of information in the first living thing? That, too, is an indication of a creator. To believe in evolution is like believing that Webster's unabridged dictionary resulted from an explosion in a printing shop. Or as Wick Ramasinghe recently said, the colleague of Sir Fred Hoyle, the famous atheist astronomer, Wick Ramasinghe and Sir Fred Hoyle, who applied the same logic to the origin of life and have subsequently adopted a creationist point of view in their book Evolution from Space, he said to believe that life arose by pure chance and natural processes and natural laws is like believing that a tornado raging through a junkyard could produce a Boeing 747. Now let me apply this to the third area, the area of new life forms. Here again, there are two views, evolution and creation. Evolution saying no intelligent intervention, purely natural laws, time plus chance plus law. Creation saying no, it takes intelligent intervention to produce new life forms. What's the difference between these two theories? Well, the difference is simply this. Evolution traditionally held to a common ancestry. Some evolutionists are talking about multiple ancestry, but that just multiplies their problems of explaining the origin. Creationists believe in separate ancestry. To us, it's like a forest, not like a tree. The phylogenetic tree is the evolutionist explanation. Creationists believe that there are many trees in the forest, variation within kinds, but no evolution between kinds. For example, creationists believe in microevolution. They believe in all the evolution you can observe in the present. They believe that changes take place in crossbreeding and genetic changes and mutations, all on a small scale. But they reject macroevolution between major kinds and forms of life, such as evolutionists traditionally describe, believe. So that what is the evidence for creation versus evolution? Well, let's take a look at the evidence and see what the evolutionists present. The evolutionists believe that if you start back at the basic life, you can move from the infantiles through the reptiles to the crocodiles to the Gentiles up on top. Or you can go from atom to Adam. You can go from the simple to the complex. They believe in total macro evolution. But what does the evidence say? When we look at the fossil record, the first thing we notice is that there is an abundant explosion of life in the Cambrian period. The life begins suddenly and abundantly in complex form, and it's boom on the scene. That phrase is a phrase taken right from an evolutionist textbook, abundantly and suddenly in the Cambrian period. When new forms of life appear, they appear without known transitional fossils, and they appear suddenly, and there is an abundance of life in the record. Evolutionists are embarrassed by the great gaps in the record. It is no exaggeration to say that it's not a question of missing links. It's a question of a missing chain. All we have is a link here and a link there. Most of the chain is gone. For example, the cover of a recent evolutionist journal called Creation Evolution suggests that the whale evolved from the cow. Now, as anyone can see, there's a whale of a difference between a whale and a cow. And there are hundreds of thousands of transitional forms missing there that, of course, the evolutionists have never been able to fill in. They do come up with a few so-called missing links. Here's one that's been touted for years by the evolutionists, Archaeopteryx. This is supposed to have been half reptile, half bird. Notice Archaeopteryx. Why is it half reptile? It has claws on its wings. So do ostriches. Does that make them a half reptile? There are two living birds, at least, with claws on the wings. No one calls them
him half reptile. Say, but he had teeth. Archaeopteryx had teeth. That makes him a half reptile. Every subclass of vertebrates, some have teeth, some don't. Some mammals have teeth, some don't. Some humans have teeth, some don't. Archaeopteryx was a bird, had perfect feathers, had wings, could fly. It's not a transitional form, and yet it's touted as one of the great examples of evolution. Another example often given is the example of coelacanth. Coelacanth was a lobe-thin fish from the Devonian period, thought to be extinct for millions of years, until fishermen off the coast of Madagascar caught some alive, looked exactly like the ones millions of years ago, hadn't changed. What happened to coelacanth? Well, one day, Ma and Pa coelacanth got grounded. Ma said to Pa coelacanth, either we're going to have to walk or starve. Over millions of years, the fins developed into legs, and coelacanth became a reptile, or something like that. Well, now, let's analyze that. First of all, there are no bones in the fins that are attached to the pelvic girdle that would make it possible for it to support the weight of the body. There are no walking fish. The walking catfish doesn't walk. It slithers along on its belly. There's no evidence that coelacanth changed. There's no evidence that coelacanth ever developed legs that needed sturdy fin for deep sea swimming. The great gap between evolution and creation is manifest by a quotation from Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan said this, "The information content of the human brain expressed in bits is probably comparable to the total number of connections among the neurons, about 100 trillion, 10 to the 14th bits. If written out in English, say, that information would fill some 20 million volumes, as many as the world's largest libraries. The equivalent of 20 million books is inside the head of every one of us. The brain is a very big place in a very small place." Now let's go back to that primeval pond, the first simple one-cell animal that appeared, enough information to fill a volume of an encyclopedia. Takes an intelligent creator. How do you get from one volume to 20 million volumes? The evolutionist tells us it's very simple. It happens by mutations and natural selection. Here's an example of mutation. Mary had a little lamb. Make a mutation on it. What do you get? Mary had a little lamb. Make another mutation. Mary bad a little lamb. In other words, when you make mutations on the genetic code, it garbles it. You don't get better information, you get worse information. So evolution believes that you can go from simple to complex, from one volume to 20 million volumes, simply by natural laws, fans blowing on alphabet soup, explosions in printing shop. Natural law plus time plus chance does not account for the difference. Says, in fact, Carl Sagan put it very well in his last quote. He said, "The neurochemistry of the brain is astonishingly busy, the circuitry of a machine more wonderful than any devised by humans." If the human brain is more wonderful than any devised by humans, a creationist says that's exactly the case. It wasn't devised by humans, and it wasn't devised by natural law. It was devised by intelligent supernatural intervention into the process. Morphology, bone structure, similarity, which we're going to hear a lot about tonight, does not account for the complex information inside the human brain. Only an intelligent intervener does. Similarity doesn't prove common ancestry. Similarity proves common creator, because it takes an intelligent being to produce specified complexity. The head paleontologist of the British Museum, Dr. Colin Patterson, said this about the so-called missing links. He's an evolutionist. He wrote a book on it. He said, "I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolution transitions in my book. If I knew of any fossil or living, I certainly would have included them. So much as I should like to oblige you by jumping to the defense of gradualism and fleshing out the transitions between the major types of animals and plants, I find myself a bit short of the intellectual justification necessary for the job." The evolutionist is short on evidence, great on theory. He is short on some known regular process by which natural laws can produce specified complexity. He is short on explaining how that which has a beginning didn't have a cause, how life came from non-life, how complex forms came from simple forms. But the creationist has a ready answer. An intelligent being created it in the beginning. An intelligent being produced the new life, and an intelligent being produced the new life forms. That's a credible rational, scientific approach to origins that I believe is superior to the evolutionary approach. Thank you.
Well, I tell you, I know how old Daniel felt facing those lions now. Man, you turn this guy loose, he eats you up. But that's good. You know, we're here to look for the truth. And that's good. I believe it was the good Lord himself said, seek you the truth and let the truth do. It'll set you free, won't it? It'll set you free, that's right. And I'm glad we're here free. I'm glad we're free today, you know. Used to be we could get together and talk like this. Used to be there were laws against it. We couldn't gather together and discuss these things. The people wouldn't let us. But we're free today, aren't we? And whenever I say that word freedom, I'm reminded of the words of that must be the greatest Baptist preacher of contemporary time. I'm free. I'm free. Great God Almighty, I'm free. I tell you, I'm glad to be free and after this truth. And in equally immortal words of Hank Williams, the good Lord willing, and the creeks don't rise, we're going to stay free. We're going to seek that truth. All right, first thing we've got to do in talking about evolution, you've got to separate it, evolution as a natural process and evolution as a theory. I'm not sure that's what Dr. Geisler's done here in his presentation. I've got to watch him 10 minutes, too. He's going to tell me when they're over with. Then I can really get started. Yeah, we've got to distinguish evolution as a naturally occurring process and then as a theory. Evolution is a natural occurring process a lot like soil erosion, like what he's talking about in the Grand Canyon. You know, it's going to go on. It's no matter what you call it. You know, you look at that soil erosion, look at that face, you tell that soil erosion, you stop. Stop soil eroding, you know. And what's the soil going to do? It's going to continue to erode. And that's just like evolution. You know, you can call it lots of things. You can call it this, you can call it that, you might even call it creationism. But it's going to go on, you know, just like soil erosion. So, it's occurring yesterday, it's occurring today. And again, in those immortal words, the good Lord willing, the creeks don't rise, it'll continue to occur in the future. So, given that fact, it seems like to me what we've got to do is come to grips with it. We've got to understand it. We just can't write it off, shrug it off, say, well, you know, I don't believe in that. What kind of explanation is that? I don't believe in evolution. Is that coming to grips with it? Is that really getting hold to it? It doesn't sound like that to me. Sounds like, you know, well, I just better not talk about that. You know, I'm just going to block that out of my mind. I'm going to just say I don't believe in evolution. I'll take care of that, and I'll go on and do something else. But it's too important to do that. We've got to come to grips with it. Got to look it straight in the face and try to understand it. All right. And so then we come to the interpretive side of evolution. How are we going to interpret it? How are we going to interpret this naturally occurring process? Well, today, evolutionary science is a tremendously exciting field, and it's exciting because there are different interpretations. People like me, people and other evolutionists, nothing we'd rather do than get together and talk about that. Talk about the different interpretations. How are we going to make sense of this naturally occurring process? It's an exciting field. We're encountering new fossils every day. There's progress made in that area. There's progress made in molecular biology. We now know that we're far more close to the chimpanzee and the gorilla than we had formerly thought. And we had formerly thought we were close. We're even closer now. That their molecular structure is amazing like ours. Even like Dr. Geisler. And they're there. They're like that. Regardless, you know, they say, well, I don't believe that. That doesn't matter, see. The molecular structure is not listening to you. You say, I don't believe in that. Well, that molecular structure is going to molecular, regardless of what you say. All right. Now, let's see what else I can say here. take up my 10 minutes so I can really get started then. All right. Dr. Geisler started with the origin of the universe in his presentation. Well, I can't do that. You know, I can't go back to the origin of the universe. I'm an anthropologist. You know what anthropology is? The word says that anthropology is the study of humans. Now, I can talk a lot about the origins of humans, and I'm fixing to as soon as my 10 minutes get over and I can get started. What's Dr. Geisler? What's his field? It's theology, isn't it? Now, is he going to talk about the origin of God? Is that what he's going to do? Now, I'm going to talk about the origin of humans. I know my subject matter. You know, I know what in and out. Now, I can start right at the beginning and go, come on up to the top. But he doesn't do that, does he? He doesn't talk about, well, how did God come to be? You know? And, of course, he's only talking about one God. He's talking about the God of Dr. Geisler. You know, the God they teach about in the Dallas Theological Seminary. He's not talking about the God that the Pope, you know, prays to. I don't think they're talking about the same God. They might be. You know, sometimes they say, well, oh, no, we're talking about the same God. You know, sometimes Baptists and Catholics say, oh, we talk about the same God. But that's when they just feel ecumenical. You know, when they really get going, when they really get at one another, they say, well, no, that's a Catholic Bible. You know, that's not my Bible. That's a Catholic Bible. So, what God are we talking about here? We're talking about the God, Dr. Geisler, and the God of some of you. I know, you know, fans of Dr. Geisler. You know, that's all right. I got my fans here, too. So, what, you know, the origin of God, that's a tremendous subject, seems like to me. But we ought to hear from that from a theologist, shouldn't we? We ought to be told, you know, where is this God comes from? Let's have the courage to face, you know, maybe we don't know. You know, maybe we don't know about the origin of the universe. Maybe we don't know about God, you know. Who is God? Let's explore that. Let's have the courage to face the unknown. Now, you say, oh, I don't want to face the unknown. You know, well, that's all right. That's all right. But, you know, if you don't want to do that, you just say, well, I don't believe in evolution. That's fine. You know, that's fine. But then you're not coming to grips with the facts. Where am I now in 10 minutes? I got 2 more minutes to spend, then I can really get at this stuff. But, you know, he talked about, you know, that a form, that those faces on Mount Rushmore, you know, that they were made there, you know, only an intelligent person could produce those faces. You know, that's an amazing statement. That really lays me low that he said that. They teach that at the Dallas Theological, I know. You know, it reminds me of an argument back in, I think it was the 18th century. The 18th century is when this argument was put forth. You know, that God is like a watchmaker. You see a watch out there laying out there on the floor, and you say, well, that watch couldn't just occur naturally. Somebody had to make it. It had to be a watchmaker, you know. Therefore, you know, here's the earth. God had to make the earth. That's all right. Well, you know, I can see that. But, you know, only trouble is that we know, we've seen watchmakers. You know, you can go down, well, you can't go downtown Baton Rouge. There's no watchmakers there. But you can go out there in Bon Marché, places like that, and maybe find a watchmaker. But when's the last time you saw a tree maker? You see plenty of trees. You know, trees got a nice lot of symmetry to it and everything. It's got a form, got a shape to it. But I haven't seen a tree maker lately. Now, some of you, you know, when you get to going and get ecstatic, you know, when the spirit's moving, you might see a tree maker. But the rest of us, we can't see tree makers. All right, I'm going to sit down now and let him. Well, evolution as a naturally occurring process, of course, produces facts. And you've got to look at the facts in order to understand what's happening. I'm going to show you some facts right now. I got them all wrapped up. These are my bags of facts. Hey, looky here. Looky here. All right, that's a fact, isn't it? I brought that along. That's mine, by the way. I brought that along so that Dr. Geisler and I could check on some points, you know, if we needed to get the gospel here. I brought that along for that. Unfortunately, though, it's not the real Bible. It's not the King James Version. It's a modern version, but we'll just have to make do with that. All right, now, you know, if I sound like a preacher, I miss my calling. That's the wrong bag. I gotta hurry up now. All right, we're gonna start out with contemporary human skull. All right, this is you. This is what you look like. This is a modern skull. You know, it sits there in my office, and I look at it every day and get a lot of wisdom from that skull right there. Because you know what this is a graduate student. This is a graduate student that just didn't make it through Dr. Ramanofsky's method and theory class. So that's how we look today. Now, I'm going to put that right there, okay? Well, as we go back down through time, you know, as we go further back through time, there ought to be a time when we don't find people who look like that. All right? If we go back yesterday, people are going to look just like that. We go back 100 years, they're going to look like that too, aren't they? What about 200, 300, 400, 1,000 years? Let's look at what they look like 10,000 years ago. 10,000 years ago, let's see what they look like. I'll find the right bag. All right. Here's what they look like 10,000 years ago. Now, well, that looked pretty much like this guy here, isn't it? Well, maybe there's not much to this thing called evolution. 10,000 years, you know, it looked pretty similar. This one's a little bigger than that, but that's just a small graduate student there. And this is a grown person here. This is Cro-Magnon. You've all heard about Cro-Magnon, haven't you? You know, fossil finds in France. All right, we'll put that in right there. Now, let's go back further. Let's go back further in time. Let's go back to 30,000 years ago and see what we got. 30, 35, 40, 100,000 years. Let's see what we find there. Now, if we find somebody back in that looks just like this, you know what I'm going to have to do? I'm going to have to shout glory and start holy rolling. But we go back 30,000 years ago. We find people look like this. Now, there's something happening. You can see that, can't you? There's something happening. And if we go back further through time, they're looking less like us. But this is Neanderthal. You've all heard of the Neanderthal man. And you probably heard those of you who are not in anthropology or haven't taken my evolution of man and culture class. You probably heard wrong. You know, because Neanderthals oftentimes depict as a rather beetle-browed sort of individual. But that's not the way it was at all. You know, he was a sensitive, caring person. You're laughing, aren't you? He was a sensitive, caring person. Now, how do I know he was sensitive and caring? Because he buried his kids. You know, and the little baby Neanderthals died for whatever, you know, reason they might have died. Maybe just, you know, got sick, whatever, and died. The adults buried them. And we dug them up. You know, we dug up the little babies and they had grave goods on them. Had artifacts and things stuck in the grave. You know? So, you know, they cared. And they worried about people. All right, we go back now. This Neanderthal, 200,000 years ago, we go back further in time, we're going to find a form that looks even less like us. We should, shouldn't we? That's what evolution says. You know, we change through time. Now, here's what we look like today. This is what we look like 10,000 years ago. This is what we look like back to about 200,000 years ago. From 200,000 on, backwards, to about 1,000,000 years ago, we look like this. Now, who in the world is that? Now, that's Homo erectus. He's in our genus, the genus Homo. We're Homo sapiens. Cro-Magnon's Homo sapiens. Neanderthal was Homo sapiens. But he was Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis to separate him out a little bit from the rest of us. But this is Homo erectus. It's a different species. Same genus Homo, but a different species. Finally, now we're getting somewhere. Now we go back, 2 million, 2.5 million years ago. We're getting pretty close to getting pretty close to the origins of these creatures we call humans. Indeed, we might, is Homo erectus a human? Certainly he's in our genus, walked erect, made tools, made fire, ate one another. All those human traits. All right, here we go. 2.5 million years ago, that's what you look like. That's Australopithecus. That's a different genus. That's what you look like. You might say, well, I ain't what I look like. But what's the evidence that this is a human? What's the evidence that it's in our evolutionary line? First of all, let me point out the trend here. The trend is in human evolution, as far as the skull is concerned, for the face gets bigger and the brain gets smaller. So we have a gradual increase in the size of the face and a gradual decrease in the size of the brain. And that just carries that trend on. But the best evidence that we have of the human status, or at least the hominid status, this genus, this fact he walked upright. And that's a characteristic that separates us today from from the chimpanzee and from the gorilla and from the rest of the apes, and indeed from the rest of the primates. None of them walk erect, bipedally on two legs like we do, normally. This is our normal load of locomotion. Now, occasionally, they can get up on their back legs, like cheetahs and Tarzan movies, and do lots of things. Get up on their back legs and bounce around, but that's not how normally they walk. Okay? So what's the evidence that that's the Australopithecus walking up? Well, that evidence is right here. That's his pelvis. That's just the bone. Pelvis. All right. Well, you say, I didn't look like my pelvis, but it does. Let me show you what your pelvis looks like. All right. Okay, that's your pelvis. That's a modern contemporary human pelvis. That's a pelvis Australopithecus. It's smaller, isn't it? But basically, it's the same thing. Now, you got to be a specialist to find out the difference. Let me compare that with a chimpanzee. Modern-day chimpanzee. The chimpanzees have evolved, too, just like we have. But this is a modern-day chimpanzee. This is modern-day human pelvis. You see, this part up here flares straight out. Here, in this part, though, it circles around. And this part here, that's the hip bone. It forms a basin. The other pelvis comes around here to form a basin. See, in the case of the chimpanzee, this goes straight out. Why is it? It's related to upright stature. If you walk erect, you got to have that basin-shaped pelvis. You got to have that basin-shaped pelvis to hold up your gut. All right. So here, this Australopithecine walked erect, had an basin-shaped pelvis. So that's one of the major reasons for putting him in direct evolutionary line. Another reason is that he doesn't look like any of the ancestors of the apes. They're pursuing a different evolutionary history. They have evolved just as we have evolved, along a different line. Okay, so let me put this Australopithecus in here.